I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
This is Barry Truce. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
This episode of Barry Truths is an interview that Hank had with Todd Zwillick, guest host of 1A. 1A explores important issues such as policy, politics, technology, and what connects us across the fissures that divide the country. The program was recorded on April 30th, 2019.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for Joshua Johnson. A.C. Hall was 17 years old in 1962 when a pair of officers approached him. They were looking for a thief and mistakenly identified Hall. The officer shot and killed him. He was black and unarmed. In the second season of the podcast, Buried Truths, host Hank Klibanoff and his students in the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory University, they delve into A.C. Hall's story and the links from past to present. Hank is the Pulitzer Prize-winning co-author of The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. The first season of Buried Truths recently won a Peabody Award. Hank joins us now from NPR member station WABE in Atlanta, where Buried Truths is produced. Hank, welcome.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you, Todd.
Good to be with you. And in addition to your other honors, I just mentioned a Peabody Award. Congratulations.
Thank you. That was something I hadn't seen in my life, but now I'm thrilled
now,
about it.
People ask you, how does it feel? But I'm interested in how it made your students feel, because they're a big part of this project in getting it researched and produced.
The ones who I've talked with who aren't in final exams are just ecstatic about it. I think they feel like they've had a hand in not just history, but more importantly, explaining history.
Now, how did the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project come into being?
I had been working with some journalists across the South back around 2008 when I left the Atlanta Journal-Constitution as managing editor, the end of 35 years as a reporter and editor. And the Center for Investigative Reporting had sort of pulled together a bunch of journalists in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana to work on some cold cases that and to try to create some sort of ongoing operation to do that. It was the opportunity to work with, like, Jerry Mitchell at the Jackson, Cleary, and Ledger, and Stanley Nelson in Louisiana, John Fleming in Anniston. And when I saw an opening at Emory University for an endowed chair there, I went for it with this idea that I would try to teach how to examine the history behind these civil rights cold cases at Emory University. And they went for it. And I'm so thrilled that they did.
Yeah, many of us who've listened to your podcast are thrilled they did as well. Cold cases from the civil rights era in the South. We're going to talk about some specifics because that's what you cover in season one and season two of Buried Truths. But how big is the universe here? I mean, how many, I don't know if there's a number, but give me a sense of what the landscape looks like, especially when you talk about unsolved cases of black people killed in the South during civil rights.
Sure. Let me say, first of all, that the scope that I have worked in, and the, as well as the other journalists that I've worked with, is generally post-World War II to, say, the assassination of Dr. King, maybe within a year or two after that. That's a very limited scope. And even that number would be impossible to determine. I mean, if you go back to post-Reconstruction into the Redemption period, you're going to find so many more, untold. I mean, we've gone through this back and forth. Should we refer to the thousands of people, or is it tens of thousands? And the fact is that until you define the universe that you're looking at, it would be impossible to know. Now, I will say this, that when Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and then FBI Director Robert Mueller back in 2006 and 7 sort of caught the fever of this and announced that they were going to initiate an FBI cold case initiative, civil rights cold case initiative, they were asked, do you have a list? And they said, sure. And they put together a list, largely handed to them by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And it had 100, and the number grew. I think it reached about 120 cases. Well, you know that isn't even close, because when we look at old records, we see references to three or four other cases that people are familiar with and that are not on anyone's list. Mm.
And the further back you go in history, I mean, I assume you would find more and more and more cases of certainly a family knows that a loved one disappeared or never came back, but there might not be any official record of it because nobody bothered.
Untold number. And families were not feeling free at that time, families of victims, to come forward and complain or even mourn publicly about this. So I sort of feel like it reminds me when I was reading the story about the bodies dug out of a construction site in Belarus the other day, and you just don't know how many or where they're buried, even in the South.
Well, let's talk about the cases that you did cover. Season one focused on a black man who was murdered after he voted in a primary election. Season two, a black man who was killed by police after being identified falsely as a burglary suspect. We mentioned him in the intro. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about these cases in the first and second season and why you think they strike a chord all these years later.
Well, they strike a chord because they sadly, they resonate today. I mean, I selected the case of Isaiah Nixon, killed in 1948 for voting, to teach in the fall of 2015, simply knowing that we're going into a big presidential election, that it's the first election or one of the first elections since the demise of the Voting Rights Act. And I thought, well, that's going to get a lot of discussion. So the students might as well be examining a historic, incident in which voting suppression was an issue. I certainly didn't realize how big an issue that would become, even right here in Georgia, all the way through this last governor's election. So I wanted it to be pertinent. The other one, A.C. Hall, shot a black kid, 17 years old, walking home from a dance or a club with his girlfriend, mistaken identity. White woman says that's him, thinking she's identifying the man who stealing a gun from her husband's car. And A.C. Hall starts to run, and the police start to fire their guns, and they kill him. And certainly that has resonance today. I mean, I will say I did start this Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases project with Professor Brett Gadsden, who was in the African American Studies Department and History Department at Emory, and who's now gone to Northwestern, back in even before the Trayvon Martin. So this was not inspired by this rash of incidents that have taken place, but it certainly fits in with them.
But you listen to the story of A.C. Hall, not only how he was shot and why, but the aftermath, the inquest, and the failure to pursue ultimately accountability for his death. And you just have to think right away of names now tragically in our own time that have become hashtags: Michael Brown, Walter Scott, Philando Castile. Sure. If those young men had been born before the age of the iPhone in Georgia in 1962, they would be A.C. Hall. They were A.C. Hall.
Well, I think, sadly, that's exactly right. I mean, we do ask the question in the podcast about A.C. Hall. What if the police officers had been appropriately investigated and prosecuted back in 1962, and so many others like them, might we have gotten to the years of the 2000s and there would have been a different outcome, a different mindset about policing, about whether or not one should be afraid and should automatically run, and whether someone should automatically pull the trigger? I don't know the answer to that, but it sure would have been nice to have had an opportunity to think about that. This has been going on for quite a long time, and it's just shocking that it doesn't stop. I will say that the other part that I really like about the second season one of the parts that I really like, is that when the A.C. Hall case went to a coroner's inquest, and these are five white men, and they're going to determine the nature and the cause of his death, they're going to render a verdict, but it cannot lead to any criminal outcome right there. He's not being found guilty or innocent. These two police officers aren't going to be found guilty or innocent. They're just gonna it's just gonna end up influencing a grand jury, perhaps. Well, these five white men listened to 2 days of testimony, and the police have all the advantages on their side. They get to testify, believe it or not, in Georgia. They get to sit in and listen to all the testimony against them and for them, and then they get to give the last word without being sworn in, without being cross-examined. And despite that, these five white men decided they didn't believe the police with their alibi that they shot in self-defense. And they rendered a verdict that said, in our opinion, this was murder. And these five white guys, four of them were born in the 1800s. They were elderly white men. And they stood up for this black kid and against these two white police officers. Now, however, when it did go to a grand jury, the grand jury said, well, in effect, in our opinion, it was not murder. And they let the police officers rejoin the police force.
Important to point out that the first proceeding was an inquest, not legally binding, if you will, so that it went to grand jury. They simply didn't charge these cops.
That's correct.
Hank, in your production, you make use of voice actors to bring us inside this testimony that you're talking about. Some of the people who were involved in this story when it happened, and some of them are around today. Here's a voice actor portraying one of the characters in your story, Doris Hopper.
I drove up behind our car, mine and my husband's, and there was a colored man getting out of the car as I drove up. He walked behind the car when he got out, right in front of the lights on the truck.
Now, I have to tell you that that was a voice actor. And I have to tell you one more thing. Doris and Barnett Hopper, a white couple now in their 70s, are still living. They declined to sit down for an extended interview. I did speak with Doris Hopper on the phone for a few minutes in January of 2019. She was gracious, pleasant, even as she declined to revisit that evening.
Hank, but as you said, you sat with the real Doris Hopper, the woman who said, that's him, who identified A.C. Hall as the man who had perpetrated a burglary, falsely identified him, as it turns out. But what did the real Doris Hopper have to say when you spoke with her?
Well, when I spoke to her, and it was by telephone, and we had been trying to get her to talk for 2 or 3 years and send her letters, make phone calls, and I don't know why on this day she gave me 9 minutes. But she just said, I don't want to talk about it. My husband's not well. We're old. We don't have good memories, those sorts of things. And I said, but I do have one question for you. Because the students go through this very agonizing process of not being sure. I mean, when Doris Hopper says that's him and A.C. Hall runs and the police shoot, the students somewhat want to hold Doris Hopper accountable for A.C. Hall's death. And yet they say, you know, they didn't pull the trigger. She didn't pull the trigger. The police did. But if she hadn't said that, they wouldn't have pulled the trigger. So I said to her, I said, just have one question, and that is, when you said that's him, did you have any idea that the police were going to start firing their guns? And she just blurts out, heavens, no, why would I? And you know, that just adds a layer, maybe it's just a thin layer, but a layer to this whole story that on the one hand satisfies our understanding of what was going on in her head at the time and complicates it at the same time.
Doris Hopper was one of the residents of Macon, Georgia, where this crime against A.C. Hall took place back in 1962. Can you paint a picture of Macon for us at that time in the early 60s and what the culture, what the people were like?
Sure. In many ways, Macon was typical of many small towns in Georgia, or medium-sized towns by Southern standards. You know, it was a lively town. It had two newspapers. The newspapers were pretty progressive. And Macon, on a scale of, you know, whatever it would, 1 to 10 in progressiveness or not in Georgia, probably would have been above average in its progressiveness. And yet it had a history of a Klan activity. It had a history of police covering up for the Klan there. It had a history of corrupt police, and that continued even after A.C. Hall. It also had this great rich history, as we know, of music. rock and soul music and rhythm and blues that came out of there. And you'll hear some of it in the podcast. You hear about James Brown, who was from Augusta, recording his first big hit, Please, 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 at WIBB in Macon. And you'll hear Little Richard, who so many people know and who's still around. He came out of there. And, of course, you know, Otis Redding.
Of course, Otis Redding. You talk a little bit about your process, though, of putting this together. You have students on the team, students doing some of the research. But I've experienced some of this in my own reporting, going back and talking to people who were there back then, even if they only give you 9 minutes. These are witnesses. You have so many witnesses in your podcast who saw these things firsthand.
Well, that's true, and I'm glad to hear you say there were so many because, as you know, when you do these things, no matter how many you have, you always feel it's just not enough, that there's one other person who's going to tell one other great story that's really going to just clarify everything for everybody. It's the students do a lot of the work, and their focus is, and I want to be clear, that both in the course and the podcast, the focus is not who done it, because we know who did it. It's the historical why. And we find historical landing places. And in the podcast, I'll stop and say, now, let's just wait a minute and look at this. How could Doris Hopper, a white woman, growing up with, you know, in Macon, Georgia, could she have misidentified A.C. Hall? What are the influences on her? And we do a whole riff on the problems of cross-racial identification. And that's where the students also thrive, investigating these sorts of things. They investigate the white predisposition to see black criminality. So if the police say in this episode, in this season, as they did in the Isaiah Nixon season, when the white people say, you know, I shot him because he pulled a gun on me. Well, back then, there was a white predisposition to believe, well, he must have, if the white guy said it, if the cop said it. What's a black kid doing walking around the town at 10 o'clock at night if he's not guilty of something? So the students really examine that, and that informs so much of what we do. The added layer that we got this time was the students giving us their reflections on this whole thing as we stood at A.C. Hall's gravesite on we went down to Macon on the exact 56th anniversary of A.C. Hall's final walk from this club in Macon, Georgia, down to where he was going with this girl to a school. They stopped, and that's when the police arrived and saw them and shot and killed him. So we retrace his final walk on the 56th anniversary, a Saturday night in October. And then the next morning we went to his gravesite, and then we went to the church where his funeral was held. And this was very emotional for all of us. And the students offered their reflections and to their phones and their phone recorders. And that really, I think, helps animate the story in very important ways.
And reporting a story like this, whether you're a professional or a student, can really bring you into contact with that person's life and what they lost and what their families lost. Here's a clip of you with one of your students, Angie Jane, both of you in this clip talking about the case.
A.C. Hall was raised, loved, and disciplined by a hard-working woman who was the sole breadwinner in their house. He was well-dressed always and competitive when it came to sports. Now, we don't have a clear picture of him as a student, but he was at least respectful to his teachers, and he was growing into a kind and thoughtful young man. My students and I struggled to learn about A.C. Hall, and that's why we talked with old friends. But it was still difficult to form a complete picture. One of my students, Angie Jang, put it this way.
Because he was so young, I mean, he passed away at the age of 17. That's a tricky age. That's too old for anyone to fully forget him and too young for anyone to fully remember him.
Hank, tell me a little bit about how your students participate here. Are they in the archives searching out documents? Are they the ones lining up at the county clerk's office trying to get records? How do they function here? Is this in this podcast that becomes their coursework as well?
Sure. Realistically, you know, when I open up each class each semester, I can't open it up and say, okay, let's today learn how to do a Freedom of Information Act request or an Open Records Act request, and let's send off the letters today and hope that within a week or so, because these students will have graduated by the time anything comes back, or their children will have graduated. So I have to have already done a lot of that work. And so their textbook, in many cases that I hand out, is whatever I can get from the FBI and the Department of Justice or the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. And that is sort of the seedbed of the work that we're going to do. They are undergraduates, and most of our cases are not in Atlanta. They are at least 2 hours away, and in some cases 3 hours away. So it is not without some difficulty that they get to a small county that's that far away. So often it happens when I arrange for us to go down there together. Often that's going to be on weekends when the courthouse is closed. So I don't, in cases where I have been able to take, in the Isaiah Nixon case, I was able to take three students on a weekday, on a Friday, into the courthouse. And I have photographs that are just astonishing of my students climbing up on these filing cabinets, reaching very high up to the ceiling to pull out these old records from the 1940s. And indeed, we found some records related to the Isaiah Nixon case that way. But that, I wouldn't say, is always the case. I will add that in that instance where we were seeking records about Isaiah Nixon, we were greeted at the courthouse by a man who showed us how to get to the cemetery where Isaiah Nixon had been buried. Now, the story of that is that he was buried after being killed for voting, and the family left and fled to Jacksonville, Florida. And when they felt it was safe to come back to that area in Georgia, they could no longer find his gravesite. And what they had not known was that in those years that they didn't feel like they could come back, the slab over his body had sunk and had gotten covered in leaves and weeds, and the headstone never had anything written on it on either side. But my student at the gravesite on that day when we'd been in the courthouse happened to be standing there and noticed an opening in the corner of the mud and the dirt and the leaves, and she could see underneath it an I and an S and on a slab of cement. And suddenly she realized, my goodness, there's a slab of cement here. And she started pulling it away, and she yelled out, I found it. And we got on our hands and knees, and we're clearing it out, sure enough. She and we had found Isaiah Nixon's gravesite 67 years after it had been lost. So that's pretty exciting field work.
Hank, you talked about how your students tried to get in touch with the kind of life that A.C. Hall led in your season two podcast of Buried Truths, and how difficult that is. As Angie Jane said, he died at 17, too young to have made an impact and too young maybe for anyone to have really remembered him. But here's Newton Collier, who was a friend of AC's in Macon, talking about how strict AC Hall's mother was.
A friend of AC Hall's had much the same recollection. Young AC couldn't always come out to play or hang out with the other kids in the neighborhood. His mother kept him close.
What did you see his mother? How did she treat him?
She was very sweet, very nice lady. She also watched over him really close.
That's Newton Collier. Newt, a boyhood friend of A.C. Hall's, who still lives in Macon.
Newt. He still lives in Macon. Maybe he wasn't so hard to find. I don't know. How'd you come across him?
He actually showed up at a talk I was giving at Mercer University. A professor at Mercer University, Sarah Gardner, had invited me to come down there and talk about the A.C. Hall case. And Newt had found out I was going to be there from another man who was very helpful to us, an African-American man named Tom Duvall. And I went the next morning and just spent the rest of the day with Newt Collier, hearing about his fascinating life. The music you heard there at the end was Sam and Dave, Soul Man. And Newt traveled Europe and much of the world with them for about 15 years playing the trumpet. So he was a great pleasure to be with for the day.
We got this message on Twitter. I am loving this conversation about cold cases involving civil rights era black Americans. These unjust acts and people must be brought to justice, even if it's through a classroom. I'll be subscribing to the podcast now, and I will be keeping tissues at hand. Keep up the great work. That's a great endorsement for your work there, Hank.
I like that.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
Well, Hank, one thing that was remarkable to me, especially in season two, you give your own perspective and your own memories of racism through your own eyes as a white person who grew up in Alabama. Mm-hmm. What was it like to go to school there, how people spoke or how they thought or what your town was like?
Well, that's fairly easy to answer because even though we had Brown versus Board in 1954 and then the implementation order in 1955, which is exactly when I was entering first grade in Alabama, it was not till my last 2 years of high school that we actually had integration. So for the first, you know, those first 11, 12 years, I'm in school with only white people. So it's all white people talking to white people and no exposure to the world beyond. My exposure to that came through the old traditional methods. You know, you have someone who shows up at the house and does cooking or, you know, helped drive me around when it was raining like the dickens and my paper route was about to wash out and I couldn't get on my bike, and she would drive me around. And those were the great loving, friendships that we had, but they weren't really an exposure to people at the core of their heart and of their being. So it was a delayed gratification for most of us that we finally got to know people of another race and another life altogether, even though we lived in the same town.
You said at one point in one episode that you remembered a textbook in your town. Yeah. Maybe at your school. I'm not really sure if it was your school or not, but a textbook that seemed to be endorsed by the county or the state.
Right, right. This was a textbook that I actually found in the course of doing the podcast and teaching the course. My cousin and his wife happened to have it in their home, and it's called Know Alabama, K-N-O-W, and it was in 1961 when I'm 12 years old. It's being circulated. It had been adopted by the County Board of Education for use in schools. I was not in a county school. I was in a municipal school district in Florence, Alabama, and I can't say that it was or it wasn't used in my school, but when you read it and you realize all the people in my county who were being taught through this book, and it says slavery wasn't such a bad thing, that slaves loved their masters, you know, it treated them as very benign slave masters. And then it talked about the Klan. Well, yeah, you know, sometimes they could go off the reservation and they could really kind of be harmful, but thank goodness they were there when the federal government wasn't, that sort of thing. And it was just sort of shocking to read this. And so it becomes part of my instruction to the students. Let me say on the A.C. Hall case, I cannot say that the two police officers, and I do not say that the two police officers who killed him were racially motivated. But I can say that they were racially conditioned. And we talk a lot about that. All of the forces that were leading people like me into a racially conditioned belief that black people were inferior. And my good fortune is that I had parents who counteracted that and who told me that that just wasn't true. But not everyone had that, or some people had it to some degree, but not everyone had it to the same degree. And I feel very fortunate to have been told, you know, without question, that is just not true.
Hank, there's another character in your story named Howard Moore. I believe he's 86. I think I got that right.
He's 87 now.
He's 87 now. Tell me a little bit about Howard Moore, how you came across him and who he is.
Oh, I really like Howard Moore. I've been reading about him and knowing about him for many years. When I first looked at the A.C. Hall inquest and the story material, this goes back quite a few years, and I just Googled him and found out, oh my gosh, he lives on the West Coast. I was on my way to the West Coast, and I met with him in the Bay Area and had a wonderful coffee with him, and handed him the transcript of that inquest. And he said, oh, my gosh, what's this going to be like when I read it? I'm going to be embarrassed. That was the first time I had ever examined or cross-examined anybody in my life in a courtroom. He was fresh out of Boston University Law School, though he was from Atlanta. And I just followed him, and then I would try to Skype him into my class. Because neither he nor I are great tech wizards, that didn't work. So finally I said, well, I'm just going to fly him out here. And we brought him to class, and then we went down to Macon to interview him. He had been working for Donald Hollowell, one of the two most prominent African-American lawyers in Georgia. And Hollowell said, you're going to go down to this inquest in Macon. And here's the law book that tells you what an inquest is in Georgia. And so he read up on it, Howard Moore did, as he's on the way to Macon. He gets to the courtroom, and you can listen to the podcast and see how that went. It's very well animated by his own recollection as well as the testimony of the actors. And in the end, you know, I told you the inquest jurors give this very surprising verdict, and it's in support of the arguments that Howard Moore has been making, that A.C. Hall was the victim of murder. He went on to do some great work. He ended up on the West Coast because he was defending Angela Davis and heading up the defense team for Angela Davis. And he has lived there ever since. He's coming back out here in a few weeks for something we call Buried Truths Live, a big event we're going to have at Morehouse.
Well, Hank, we're starting to get to the end of our time together. But in retrospect, after you've produced these two seasons, I mean, how willing were people to go back and relive A.C. Hall's death or Isaiah's death, whether in interviews or helping with records or telling what they knew? And I really want to know, I mean, was it divided along racial lines, people who were willing to talk and people who weren't?
No, not at all. This whole thing would not have happened if Dorothy Nixon Williams, the daughter of Isaiah Nixon, who saw him shot and killed when she was 6 years old, hadn't been willing to help meet with us and explain to us and over and open her heart and her home to us. On the other hand, The family of the young woman who A.C. Hall was walking with on the night that he was killed, and who you'll hear about in the podcast, her children will not respond to our many, many, many messages and overtures to help us understand her and what they grew up with about knowing about or hearing about as far as that incident. So it's a mixed bag. More people want to help than don't. And I think that over time, it gets a little bit easier to help. Some people are curious, and some people just say, you know, I don't want to learn what I don't already know. And so it's a real mixed bag. But one thing is for certain, the students and I will keep knocking on doors, and we will keep asking and offering people an opportunity to help explain that history.
And we'll be hopefully right along with you there as you do it. I want to say, Hank, before we let you go, you do this project with your students. They help report it. They help with the research. They help produce it. I couldn't help feeling while listening. Entertained, yes, but I felt like we were all in your class a little bit.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And you're welcome anytime.
Season 3 coming, by the way.
It is, and it's terrific. It's the one I've taught more than any others, and partly because we found between 1,000 and 2,000 pages of a trial transcript that so informs the story. And so I'm very excited about it.
Hank Libanoff is the director of the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory University. He's the author of The Race Beat, The Press, The Civil Rights Struggle, and The Awakening of a Nation. Hank, you mentioned Otis Redding from Macon. Well, this is Otis Redding to help take us out of the hour. This is These Arms of Mine.
That was Buried Truths host Hank Libanoff in conversation with Todd Zwillick, guest host of 1A. The program was recorded on April 30th, 2019. We do want to say congratulations to Hank Libanoff and the rest of the Buried Truths team because the podcast is now a Peabody Award-winning podcast. It was one of just 5 podcasts that got that distinction, and it was for Season 1 of Buried Truths, the story of Isaiah Nixon. And there's still time to see Buried Truths live in Atlanta. The event is coming up on May 21st. The live show will feature Hank Klibanoff along with special guests and behind-the-scenes insights. For more information and tickets, visit wabe.org/community. Buried Truths is a production of WABE, Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.